Welcome to Michigan Writers on the Air, a program about writers, writing, reading, and listening here in northern Michigan. I'm Aaron Stander. In the opening segment of the program, I will be talking with Elizabeth Bazzelli about her newest crime novel, Dead Dogs and Englishmen. In the middle, I'll be chatting with veteran journalist Jacob Wheeler about his book on third world adoption, Between Light and Shadow. At the end, regular contributor, poet and essayist Fleeta Brown will be here with some thoughts on Edna St. Vincent Millay. I'd like to welcome Elizabeth Bazzelli back to Michigan Writers on the Air. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thank you. I'm here.
You're here, and you're going to be talking about the fourth in your Emily Kincaid series.
Yes.
I've enjoyed them all, and the fourth certainly was perhaps the longest and most complicated plot yet.
Oh, absolutely. But it's also getting the best response, except for people who hate me when they think I'm trying to kill off a dog in there.
Well, we should talk about that. But before we go to the fourth one, Dead Dogs and Englishmen, can you give our listeners some background if they haven't read the rest of the series? How did this start? Where is it placed? Who are the characters?
How did it start? It started with my moving up here and meeting people up here, people I just couldn't believe. They were so different than city folks.
Yep.
And they intrigued me because when they spoke to me, they spoke directly from the heart, no filters in between. And as I met them, I knew these were characters in a book. And of course,
they didn't know it yet.
They didn't know it yet. Maybe some of them don't know it. Deputy Dolly was a police officer who used to roam the back roads where I live, back in the woods. And again, she was a wonderful character, just this human woman who was trying to make her way in the world as a police officer, maybe in an area where they didn't take to women police officers that well. So I was fascinated with her. And then the other people, Harry Mockerman is this elderly man who used to come in and visit. He had been a log skidder back in the last of the logging days.
Yes.
And he had wonderful stories, and he lived off the woods. I don't think old Carl ever had a license for anything in his life, not his car, not to go hunting. If he was hungry, he took his gun and went out in the woods. And that was the way he had known it all his life. So just fascinating people.
So here you are, a veteran writer, but you moved north about how many years ago?
I think it was 6 years ago.
These characters appear and a plot starts to appear and you go out and you find a publisher. And what were you looking for in the beginning? One book or a series or what?
Well, I only had the one book. And then the publisher called me and he offered me a 4-book contract. So guess how fast I came up with other books? And he wanted the titles that day. He was going to give me half an hour. He was going to call back because he needed them for the contract. So I sat there racking my brains. Oh, my God, what am I going to write about? And they just started coming to me. And in this last one, Dead Dogs and Englishmen, the Noel Coward song, Mad Dogs and Englishmen, that my brother used to love and listen to, was just going through my head. And so I wrote it down, had no idea what that story could possibly be. So you know how you do things in advance and you never think you're actually going to get there?
So essentially, you had the one book and you had three titles.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't know what those three titles were going to be.
I had
no clue.
No plots whatsoever.
So for a writer, this is an incredible writerly, intellectual kind of activity.
Oh, yeah.
You had the title and you had to figure out what would go with it.
I was doing some mental gymnastics, let me tell you. What's this going to be? But amazingly, writing to title worked for me. I had this parameter, and then I just went in and came up with a story to go with it. So I'm happy with the way things worked out.
That's just so fascinating that you were able to do that. The characters in this book, many of them appear in the earlier books. First of all, you have the protagonist that runs through the series.
Mm-hmm.
And she is?
Emily Kincaid.
And she's about 30.
She's in her 30s somewhere. I don't know. Somewhere in her
30s. 30-something.
30-something,
and
right.
She, too, has moved to the woods.
Yes, yes, to write mysteries. Jeez. How did that happen?
And you moved from Metro Detroit, and she moved from Ann Arbor. Mm-hmm. And she moved from a problematic marriage.
Well, he was a philandering English professor at U of M.
Hard to believe that there can be anyone like that.
I know, but I based him on someone from my graduate years there, too. A very funny guy who I think was on his sixth wife by the time I left the school. And of course, she's going to get out of everything and go up north. She's got the money. They shared everything. She goes up north and gets her little cabin on a little lake back in the woods and starts to write her mysteries, which turn out to be pretty crappy mysteries because nobody wants them. But she needs money. And that's really comes into play in this book, this last one, Did Dogs and Englishmen. She needs money, and she'll do a lot for money.
Yeah, along the way, she's been working for an area newspaper, and I say along the way, over the last three books.
Yes, uh-huh.
And now she gets an opportunity to make a lot of money.
Oh, all of a sudden, this man's going to pay big.
Editing
his novel, he's writing a biography of Noel Coward. This is the definitive biography. Nothing will top it. And of course, she'll do the editing because he's offering lots of money.
What is it? Couple thousand bucks for every few chapters.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, a lot of money.
Totally improbable, but he has money. So she figures he's just a rich man without good sense. And so she doesn't mind taking the money.
Well, she does feel guilty all the way to the bank.
Oh, yes, she does.
Okay, this is about 1 year in Emily's life, these four books.
Mm-hmm.
It's about 5 years in your life.
Mm-hmm.
How has your approach to this character changed? Because you've been living with her for a long time.
Both of them, Dolly and Emily.
Dolly and Emily and the ex-husband, a little bit, Jackson Rinaldi.
That every woman in the country wants to kill. That's all I hear from women across the country is you've got to get rid of him and do it badly.
Oh,
just do him in.
Poor Jackson.
But naturally, because he incenses everybody, I'm going to keep him in the books.
So the characters have become much more complex. How does that happen?
Because you get to know them so much better than you had at first. In a year, I didn't get to know them. But now, over all these years that we've spent together, I do know them, and I know what they're capable of, and I know what their failings are, and I know what their dreams are. And so I have things to work with from book to book. It's easy. Once you've got your characters, once you've got your setting the way I have, all I have to do is go in and impose story on what I know of these people in this place already.
And this book is very different from the earlier books.
It is.
I think that they would fall in the classification of cozies.
Yeah, the earlier ones.
In crime fiction, a cozy is...
It's just a sort
a cover
of a lighter,
for a teapot.
and we have to be careful how we murder people off because you don't want too much blood. So this one was very different.
Yeah, the earlier murders were done very delicately,
I heard,
at a distance.
Yes, and I heard from one woman already who said, "Well, now I hope you've got this violence out of your system."
So this book moves really from the cozy category to
a mystery, just a down to earth mystery.
Yeah,
I haven't moved to thriller yet, but I'm there.
You're pushing the edge a little bit.
Yeah, I think it did lead me in that direction and into a different kind of book, which I've just finished.
So maybe you could read a little bit from this book to get us.
Okay, why don't I read just the beginning, and then I'll read a little bit about Harry Mockerman, who was her neighbor across the street, and people seem fascinated with Harry. Harry is the man who lives off the land, so this is the beginning. The deadly summer of the worm began in spring when a tent worm's crawled into my northwest Michigan woods after May blossoms faded on the wild cherry trees and tiny leaves first appeared on the Juneberry. When the trees bloomed again with thick gauzy webs at every fork of their branches. Each of the sticky white webs woven into the blackened and sickly trees writhed with thousands of worms. I tried not to notice the moving webs when I walked with Sorrow, my happy lump of a mixed-breed dog. I hoped the worms would go away, that maybe the birds would feast on them. Maybe I thought they'd turn into moths and be nothing more than a nuisance after summer dark, pulsing around my porch lights and bombarding the window screens with buzzing thumps. That wasn't what happened. None of that. A little further, Emily is up at the road getting her mail and walking Sorrow. She sees Harry across the road from her, and Sorrow goes off to meet him. I shut the mailbox door as Sorrow romped ahead down the road. Old Harry Mockerman, my handyman neighbor and teacher of wood smarts, was out on his usual morning quest. Bent over at the far side of the street with a shovel and a coal scoop in his hands, a silhouette in the streaming sunshine. He was salvaging a dead raccoon, roadkill from the night before. Harry found roadkill an easy supply of meat for his soups and stews, kind of like the crows who hung around for the same reason. Harry ate everything except skunk, or so I like to think. Rabbits were at the top of Harry's list, he'd once told me, then came birds. In a jumble behind those two were raccoon, squirrel, chipmunks, and once a fox. I'd tried most of them. Not bad, not good. Harry knew how to live off the land around him and was teaching me, though there were some things I wouldn't stoop to, like stuffing a flattened chipmunk.
When I read that originally, I was trying to visualize how you would begin to do anything with the chipmunk.
Well, but, I guess if you're hungry enough.
And later in the book, he teaches her how to can fish.
Yes.
I wasn't quite sure about that either.
Yeah,
but,
I got a recipe from a woman in Kalkaska who called me and told me how to can fish and how to make put a secret ingredient in there so it tasted like salmon when you opened it rather than just scavenged fish. So I have help. I get help from everywhere.
Well, this book, you perhaps needed some help because there is so much here that's very different. We have this strange character, Cecil Hawk, the mm-hmm. Englishman, the poor English lad who makes good, sort of Dick Whittington, but not really.
Not really.
His tall actress, slightly batso wife, Lila.
Yes.
We have sheep farming references mm-hmm. from, what, New Zealand or Australia?
Well, it actually his friend there yes. was from Australia, the one who was supposedly running the sheep ranch. But that's all a cover for something much more
sinister.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Oh, boy. And then we have Noel Coward. Uh-huh. And this guy, Cecil Hawk, is so taken with Noel Coward and mm-hmm. Noel Coward memorabilia. Mm-hmm. Where did this all come from and what kind of research went with this?
Well, because I had the song, Mad Dogs and Englishmen, that I had to use in the book. I mean, once I knew that it was Dead Dogs and Englishmen, I had to do something with Noel Coward. Now, what the heck? How am I going to bring Noel Coward into this Northern Michigan book? So I brought my Englishman in, who is just in love with Noel Coward and all his work. So, yes, I had to do a lot of research. And I went to Ten Chimneys, which is outside Milwaukee, the Lundfontein estate, and stood in Noel Coward's bedroom, and I heard all kinds of stories about Noel Coward, risque kinds of stories, and I knew that he would be perfect for this particular Englishman. And so I brought all of that, and then Blythe Spirit, his play, they give a party based on Blythe Spirit, at which there is a seance and And I use that and play with it, too. Mm-hmm. Such fun.
And it was great. It is great fun. It's a great scene in the book. You approach writing mysteries in your own unique way, and you actually work out the plot fairly carefully, or at least you complete the last chapter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I have to when I start. I have to know where I'm going. And it makes it so much easier to write because I have an end point to shoot for. So when I'm working on the threads that create the plot, this tapestry that I'm doing, I know where those threads have to come in. And I know where they have to go, where they're heading, and then where I have to start getting them together, gathering them at the end so that I have that ending. Sometimes the ending changes. In this one, it didn't. I knew what I wanted to do to some bad people at the end of the book. And
when it feels so good.
Oh, I stood up and I was cheering all by myself in my studio. You did it. You got him. I enjoy writing these things.
This contract is done. These four books are done.
Mm-hmm.
But you leave these characters, well, you leave your readers wanting to know more about these characters. What's going to happen? Is the series going to continue? What's next for...
I've promised people the series would continue. I just don't know exactly how it's going to work out because I've just finished another book of another sort in another series, and that's with my agent right now. So I don't know, but I can't leave them the way I...
No, you can't.
I can't do that. People have said to me, you can't do that to Dolly. So I've already talked to the agent about it, and we're going to look at these and the outlines I have of two more books. But first we have to address this new thriller that I finished and have out there.
Would you talk about that for a few minutes, or could you? Or is that still too much of a secret?
No, it's not a secret. It's about, actually, this one takes place in Detroit.
Which is where you spent...
most of my
adult
my life,
yeah.
Yes,
or,
right.
Or life, totally.
And I felt comfortable taking it down there, and I know the places. And it's about a great evil that it has come to the United States, and... it begins with the death of the philosopher. The title is The Dead Philosopher's Wife. And then she's left with this mystery of papers that he hid somewhere, and someone very evil is after them, after her. And she ends up living down, she's a social worker. She ends up living amongst the homeless down in Detroit. And they're wonderful people. Just, there's a Tourette's lady, and there's a midget who's, well, a little person who's only 4 feet tall. She has dreads with golden earrings in each of her dreads, and she uses these people, they use her, and they solve everything. And I'm charmed by all of them. I'm charmed by the poor who are... they aren't one-dimensional people. They have personalities. They have dreams and hopes, and they are there to help you. So that's what I drew on in this book, and I hope it's as good as I wanted it to be.
Now, a lot of listeners are interested in the whole process of going from writing to print. You've been a professional writer for 40-some years, but it's always a tough process. You finish mm-hmm. this book. I know how engaged you were in this book while you were writing it. And then the next step is to move towards publication. I know you've gone through various agents along the way.
Yeah, had to fire one.
and now you have a new agent. How did you get that agent? How did this all play out?
Well, last year, when I was just starting the book, I wrote to an agent I wanted to be with. And she emailed me back, and I sent her all of my books, and she looked at those. And then she said to me, but I have to see the whole manuscript on this one. Mm-hmm. And so when I had it done, I contacted her, and she wasn't accepting queries or anything for a month. So mm-hmm. I sat there for a month chewing my fingernails. And finally in September, I just sent it off, not the book, just an email, and reminded her, and she said, "Oh, send me the novel. Yes, I'd love to see the manuscript." That morning, I sent it off. As luck would have it, 2 hours later, I got an email from an editor at Thomas Dunn, St. Martin's. Mm-hmm. She had seen a review of Dead Dogs and Englishmen, which has been getting great reviews, and wanted to see the book and asked if I had anything she might be interested in looking. That was 2 hours after I sent the manuscript up. So actually, when you have something like that, you can go to almost any agent because they know you've already got the groundwork done.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wanted to stay with this woman. And she called me, wanted to represent me, and she's so excited about the book. She emailed me this Saturday, this Sunday. She's just, she's like the dream agent.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very happy with where I am, but it's not easy. But one agent told me, don't ever give up. Get 10, out to 10 agents at a time. As you get in a rejection, get them out to another one. Have your list. You can have an A, B, and C list of agents if you've done your research. But never give up. People mm-hmm. give up too soon. That's the problem.
Well, very passionately put. Elizabeth, it's always great talking to you. It's always great having your next book to read. Your website is
www.elizabethbazelli.com.
And that website contains a list of where you're going to be next, classes that you're going to teach,
yes,
references to your books,
and a blog. Mm-hmm.
And it's a beautifully designed website designed by
my grandson, John Mullen.
Oh, good for him. I wish we all had such talented...
such a grandson.
Exactly. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And we look forward to the next book.
Oh, me too.
You're listening to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. I'd like to welcome Jakob Wheeler to Michigan Writers on the Air. Jakob is a freelance journalist, the editor at uptake.org, and the publisher of the Glen Arbor Sun. Today we will be talking about your recently published book, Between Light and Shadow. It's been getting a lot of attention. Let's go to the beginning of the story. What took you to Guatemala in the first place?
In 2003, I moved to Guatemala and began learning Spanish in a city in the Mayan Indian Highlands. I wanted to learn the language.
So that was the purpose, just to learn the language?
Yeah. Yeah, it was a Spanish immersion course in the fall of 2003. Through that process, though, I felt deeply in love with the country, with the culture, the Mayan Indian cultures, with the highlands, the volcanoes, the volcanic lakes, the Mayan Indian traditions. And I felt a calling, really, to learn about, and as a journalist, as an activist, as an empowered American, I felt a calling to try to help tell Guatemala's history, in particular with relation to the United States.
So we should place Guatemala. It is right below Mexico. It is right below Chiapas, the poorest state in Mexico. Mm-hmm. What is Guatemala like economically?
Well, it's in rough situation. It went through a horrible civil war between 1960 and 1996, between kind of a right-wing militaristic government and leftist rebels. Guatemala is a country literally run by an aristocracy that makes up 1 or 2% of the country and owns all of the wealth, the land. It's still very much a farming agricultural country, and that other than Guatemala City, there's really no urban areas. Guatemala, the story of Guatemala going back to the late 1880s is that of Germans and other Europeans arriving, Spaniards as well, of course, and expropriating mass tracts of land for coffee farming, corn farming, fruit farming, and putting the indigenous population, probably about 60 to 70% of the country is fully or partly Mayan Indian blood, putting them to work. Serfdom, if you will. Today, the effect of that is that probably 51 to 60% of the country lives on less than $2 a day, and maybe up to 30% lives on less than $1 a day. Extreme poverty. These are kind of UN figures. It's a desperate situation. The Civil War nominally ended in 1996, But Guatemala today is a very dangerous place rife with murder. Feminicide, the word for preying on innocent women. And gangs and the drug trade have really taken over and filled the vacuum that was left when the military disbanded in Guatemala in the mid-90s.
So how did you learn about the adoption trade? How did you get this particular story?
When I began working towards an MFA in creative nonfiction through a school out East Goucher College and was living in Guatemala at the time, I was searching for a story to tell that was set between Guatemala and the United States, where I could tell a story that involved these two settings and characters between those two settings. And I thought, what would be, you know, a hot button story to tell? I thought of the immigration story. That's very, very important, of course. Tens of thousands of Guatemalans attempt to come across Mexico to the United States every year. But that story has been told and is being told. Foreign adoption was huge in the middle part of the last decade. And it was, for reasons that we'll talk about soon, it was loved and hated and very controversial in Guatemala, in the Guatemalan media, kind of the Guatemalan identity. And no one had attempted yet to tell a story of Guatemalan adoption from the perspectives of both the American family and the Guatemalan family. And I thought, what an opportunity.
Mm-hmm. So the basics are that if someone wants to or wanted to, this came to an end in what?
About 2008. Yeah, 2008. The Guatemalan Congress pulled the plug on this. The State Department also was complicit.
But before that, if someone wanted to adopt a child from Guatemala, who were the players and how did this happen?
What made adoption from Guatemala unique in the world, it was the only country that essentially had a privatized adoption system. They called it a notary system where to adopt the child and take them back to the United States. And by the middle of the last decade, I should say that this was almost exclusively an American phenomenon. European countries stopped adopting from Guatemala 10, 15 years ago. The approval of an adoption would come from a private sector judge, a notary, not approved by the central Guatemalan government, which was the case with China, Russia, other countries, former Eastern Bloc countries, and other Latin American countries in the past where adoption was controlled by the state. The arbiters of adoption were then adoption attorneys who either a pregnant, desperate woman who wanted to relinquish her child for adoption could seek out an attorney in Guatemala City, or, as we see in the book and, you know, as the allegations suggest, oftentimes attorneys would seek out desperate, poor women who had many children and would occasionally offer them money to give up their children. Those attorneys could make $15,000-$20,000 on the transaction. And of course, there was an unlimited supply of children of desperate, poor, illiterate, impressionable mothers from which to choose.
Mm-hmm. So for the people involved, for the lawyers involved, and for the quasi-agencies involved,
mm-hmm.
we're talking about hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars at some point.
That's right. That's right. As I write in the book, not, you know, Guatemala's main source of GDP by any means. Textiles, fruit, coffee would supersede adoption. But I write that, you know, in America today, I think it's fair to say that, first of all, there's probably a Guatemalan adoptee in almost every community. And if you're walking through the mall or on a bus or at the airport, when you see, you know, a beautiful chocolate-skinned baby in the arms of lily-white parents, that's often perceived as being more present, as being Guatemala's greatest export, more so than a package of coffee or fruit or clothing that we might not always look on the tag and say, you know, hecho en Guatemala.
Mm-hmm. You do a really interesting thing with this book because you provide the background very clearly laid out, and then you shift over to a story about an American family, a Guatemalan family, and a child.
Mm-hmm. By chapter one, it's a narrative journey. The first half of the book is set in the past, in the past tense. I've through interviews with the Guatemalans and the Americans, I've tried to recreate the steps, recreate all of the events that happened before I kind of came into the picture as matchmaker, as documentarian. And so there's a touch of magical realism. I'm honest with the reader and tell them, you know, Of course, not everything that happens in here I was there to witness or don't know for sure. But the facts stand alone. The facts are true that, you know, this girl, Ellie, her name as a Guatemalan was Berenice. She was relinquished. Her mother gave her up, and she was not the first of her siblings to be given up for adoption after her mother was pressured by attorneys. The second half of the book is written in the present, and it's written in the first person. I come in as a character.
Mm-hmm.
I struggle with that occasionally because this story is not about me. I don't know what it's like to be a mother or a child, to give up a child, or to be you know, a bicultural kid who all of a sudden faces the clash of my past and my present. I don't know that, but I felt that because I became such a big part in the story as documentarian, as translator, and as really the facilitator of this reunion, there was no way I could write this without including myself as well.
And you were very much part of the story. Mm-hmm. The American family asks you if you can find the birth family,
yeah,
the birth mother.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very interesting process. Do you want to talk about how you actually did that? Because you didn't have a lot to go on.
Right. Searching for Antonia is the first chapter in the second half of the book. Well, yeah, Judy, the adoptive mother, without telling her daughter Ellie that we were doing this, said, you know, there's a hole in my daughter's heart. A part of her is missing. I want her to know what became of the family that gave her up.
And from Judy's point of view, this is a fairly enlightened adoptive parent who's ready to allow the child to trace her roots.
Yes, and I think that Judy is a great representation of kind of the new age of adoptive parents who adoption, both domestic and international, really has been revolutionized, I think, the last 10, 15 years in that many players are more open now to the connection with one's past, whereas the prevailing wisdom used to be, you know, you throw that away. Obviously, a child is relinquished under painful circumstances. They don't need to have any connection at all to their past life. That's different. So I think Judy was a great representation. Judy still had the adoption dossier of Berenice Ellie's adoption. We worked from that. There were inaccuracies. There were trails that led us to brick walls, so to speak. And there was some confusing things. Ellie, for example, remembered that she was from El Salvador, not Guatemala, which was very suspicious. She initially, at least, mispronounced the name of what she thought was her home village. She was, of course, 7 years old when she was relinquished, and probably lots of seven-year-olds can't quite pronounce the name of their hometown. This is an innocent mistake. But I returned to Guatemala in 2005 and began digging, doing paperwork, interviewing people. Ultimately went to a town that we thought sounded similar to the town that Ellie had pronounced to look for traces. Went to the hospital to look for birth records. Went to the town hall where I encountered this pretty incredible character of a record keeper who really...
That's a great scene in the book.
Yeah, El Señor Jerónimo Méndez. If it weren't for him, I don't know, where we'd probably still be searching for her. He was this gallant, stoic old man who really, once I told him the story, Ellie's story, or the fact that I was looking for the birth mother, he helped out. And he also had some very, very interesting insights into his perspective on adoption.
And in the process of doing this, you put yourself at some risk. You are riding the chicken buses, so mm-hmm. named because people...
People carry live poultry on them. Yeah, these the public transportation in Guatemala. These are actually old American school buses.
I think that, Tenek, New Jersey was...
Yeah. The one of the buses that goes between Tiquisate, the town where Ellie, of course, is from, and Guatemala City is a bus. It still says Tenek, New Jersey School District on it.
And you often were carrying no money because it's dangerous to carry money.
Yeah, I'm a target, a gringo. Yeah, that's an interesting question, you know, to what degree there was danger. I mean, Guatemala is a very dangerous place, as we talked about earlier. And adoption is or was very taboo. I didn't want there are kind of infamous cases in the early to mid-90s before the Civil War ended when human rights activists, foreigners down there with good intentions were suspected of being there to steal children and were beaten. There was a woman from California who was almost beaten to death because she may have picked up a child and said, "How pretty."
Mm-hmm.
There was danger. There was there were at least a couple cases of attorneys or NGO workers who were investigating Guatemalan adoption, kind of before this book was written, who lost their lives, perhaps presumably at the expense of or at the hands of those who profited from the industry. We'll never know. So I was real subtle. I didn't. A lot of people who I met, I didn't tell why I was truly there. When I searched for Ellie's past, her birth mother, I often told people that, you know, that I was a friend of the family, which of course was true, but not that I was a journalist and from the United States and writing a book.
So eventually, you were able to find the birth family, and you were able to bring Ellie back to Guatemala with her mother to meet them. Do you want to talk about how that happened, how that worked out?
Judy had come down to Guatemala earlier and had already met Antonia, the biological mother, as well as one of Ellie's two brothers, Minor, her older brother. And so, you know, Judy and I were kind of familiar with the characters. Of course, it was very unpredictable how it would go down when Ellie came. There were several phases and all kinds of different emotions. Initially, there were happy tears and lots of testimony and kind of catching up on 7 years and learning, you know, Antonia's memories of Ellie and Ellie's memories of Antonia and her brothers Minor and William and the home village of Tiquisate. And then this interesting, the reunion took only about 48 hours, really, 48 hours before the Guatemalans were supposed to get back on the chicken bus and return to their village. The reunion took place in touristy and luxurious and safe Antigua, as opposed to the poor village of Tiquisate. There was, shortly after kind of the emotional outpour of the reunion, there was this kind of period of silence where who knew where it was going to go. And Ellie began to bond in this incredible way with her two brothers. She was 14 at the time. They were, I believe, 15 and 17. They didn't speak any English. She had forgotten all of her Spanish, basically. They couldn't communicate the way we're communicating right now. But they were communicating, and it was invisible to the rest of us initially, but they were communicating in this way that I think that only siblings can, you know, almost like whales using sounds in the ocean, right, that none of us can understand.
Yeah.
And it led to this incredible bond, and I think we were foolish not to think how painful it would be to separate them once again. I mean, Ellie was supposed to return a few days later to the Traverse City to resume the sixth grade. And Minor and William were supposed to return to Tiquisate and go back to the banana plantations, which is, in its own right, you know, another tragic separation that they were already forced to endure once before.
And they had left school at second or third grade.
Yeah, none of these kids had much schooling. There wasn't the money. And unfortunately, there is not the culture of education in these villages. And so ultimately, Ellie went missing. The boys went missing. It was very hard for Judy when she began to realize slowly what had probably happened. Initially, there was a thought that they had kidnapped her. It dawned on us that this was more of, you know, an emotional. The boys and the girl just wouldn't let themselves be separated again. They weren't actually putting anybody in danger. It was more emotionally tormenting than it was physically tormenting. But they ran away, and all of a sudden, the story took a turn that I never foresaw. And I guess as a writer, I'd thought that the reunion itself would be the denouement, right? The conclusion.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, a new conclusion materialized. If you like, I can read a bit.
Oh, I would love that part. Yes.
I'll read then what happens the morning after we realize that the kids have disappeared. It takes us a good hour to get to Santa Lucia and then navigate the labyrinth of washed-out dirt roads leading to Voner's house. Voner is Antonia's boyfriend at the time. Antonia, of course, is the biological mom. Antonia keeps pointing with her hands, either to the left or to the right, to give directions, even though she is seated in the back behind the driver, and he keeps making wrong turns as a result. But, sure enough, by around 9, Antonia beckons him to stop next to a little embankment, and the two mothers hop out of the car before it has even come to a halt and scramble up the slope with the agility of teenagers. I slowly get out of the car and tell the driver to take a well-deserved nap, saying, "We may be here a little while." And I follow Antonia and Judy down the dirt path toward Wauner's one-room brick house, maybe 50 feet from the road, which is surrounded by beautiful banana and mango trees. Paradise. Sitting on a wooden bench next to a pila cistern in front of the house are Minor, William, Wagner, and Berenice. Berenice is Ellie, waiting patiently for us. I clear the embankment just as Judy reaches her daughter and embraces her in a fantastic hug. But the girl cannot reciprocate. She is torn between her adoptive mother and her brothers. Judy takes Ellie gently by the hand into the house where they can talk, but the girl keeps looking to her right, out the open doorway, at Minor and William, whom Antonia has approached and is giving hell for running away without telling anyone. I catch up to the scene and walk into the house, just as Judy holds out and unfolds Ellie's American passport, the mid-morning sunlight illuminating the white eagle and the document's blue background. Ellie, do you really want to give up this and everything it stands for? Your education, your future, your sisters, your dad and me, and return to this poverty in Guatemala? Do you really want that? Because if you stay here now, you'll be throwing it all away. Everything you have been given and everything you have accomplished since we adopted you. Judy will never forget the completely blank look that comes over the girl's face at that moment, standing on the dirt floor of a one-room brick house in the middle of the jungle, surrounded outside by the love that reared her and then abandoned her, and staring straight at the woman who has given her shelter and love and that dark blue passport. Judy is tired, desperate, and hurt. Ellie resists the obvious urge to turn her head to the right and look out into the sunshine at the woman who gave birth to her and the brothers with whom she grew up. Instead, she focuses on Judy. I don't know, Mom. I don't know what to do. A long pause, and then, can you make the decision for me? Of course the decision will be made for her. Of course Judy's was not an open-ended question. Of course the girl will return to the United States with Judy on Thursday. Whether she likes it or not, she is Ellie Walters. She lives in Traverse City, Michigan, in a nice two-story house on Old Mission Peninsula. She attends sixth grade at Traverse City Central, excels in the junior high girls' basketball team, and attends summer camp at the prestigious Interlochen Arts Academy where she is a voice major. And yes, she owns that American passport with the eagle on it, the document coveted by so many. The match today here in this jungle in Central America was not going to be fair. In fact, it was fixed to begin with. Two poor Guatemalan boys with no money, no resources, and no valuable passports never really stood a chance against the middle-class white woman from the United States when it came to fighting over the 14-year-old girl they all love and need so badly. At the end of this week, Guatemala's most valuable natural resources, its children, will still be leaving the country on airplanes for El Norte. And this particular case will be no different. At the end of the month, Guatemala's role will still be one of subservience to the United States of America. Outside, Minor has picked up a knife and is carving into a ripe mango he plucked from the tree. The blade cuts open the fruit, but the juices bleed all over his hands, the process messy. He pleads to anyone who will listen, Antonia, Wagner, even me. Ella no quiere salir. She told me she doesn't want to go. She wants to stay here with us. And that familiar, impressionable look of marvel comes over Antonia's face again as she turns and looks at us gringos as if she expects us to answer Minor with a sparring of words. It's the same look she gave when we told her Ellie was in sixth grade and liked to sing and draw. The same look on her face when the doctor told her 2 days ago that if she didn't have a hysterectomy, she would probably die. It could be the same look on her face after Doña Ceci told her to give up her 7-year-old girl all those years ago. He says Berenice doesn't want to go, Antonia tells us, nodding toward Minor. At that, the translator, narrator, uneasily sheds the remnants of his objectivity, knowing that the outcome has already been decided. It just needs to be justified. Antonia, Berenice is very confused. She's a fragile 14-year-old girl, and she's torn between her Guatemalan and American families. She doesn't know what's best for her right now. There is no response from Minor, and Antonia just stares. You will see Berenice many times during your lifetimes. The voice is directed toward Minor and William. She will come back and visit often, I'm sure. She loves you, and you are an important part of her life. This is only goodbye for a little while. You are not losing her the way you did the last time. William is bowing his head and nodding silently, as if he is sorry for their actions, but Minor has dropped the mango and the carving knife and retreated to the bench, where he holds his head in his hands, crying hard. By now, Judy and Ellie have left the house and are standing in the crowd. The narrator backs up a few steps and addresses the crowd, repeating the questions in both Spanish and English several times, so everyone understands. This girl belongs to both of your families. She is both Guatemalan and American, and she will probably spend her life going back and forth between these two countries. She loves all of you and needs all of you equally. But for her to be happy, those that love her need to be willing to share her, even if that means knowing you won't see her all the time. Who here loves this girl so much that they are willing to share her? Levanta la mano. Raise your hand. First, William and Judy simultaneously answer the call, their right hands shooting up into the air. A moment later, Vonner does, and he nudges Antonia, who might not have completely understood the question, but raises her hand nonetheless. Sadly, it is only Minor, sulking, defeated, on the bench, a day shy of returning to the banana finca, and probably less than a year away from marrying Guadalupe, who doesn't respond. The girl looks around the crowd, at her brother, her two mothers, and Vonner, arms all bent at the elbow and raised, and though her back is turned to me, I think she smiles.
Wow. That's Jakob Wheeler reading from Between Light and Shadow, a beautiful book, just a compelling read. I want to change the subject just for a bit. We only have a couple of minutes left. You're now living in Minneapolis, but you're still very closely connected to this area because you are the editor and publisher, and have been for quite a while, of the Glen Arbor Sun. Could you tell our listeners about that?
Sure. Well, the Glen Arbor Sun is based in Leelanau County and covers kind of southern Leelanau County, Glen Arbor, Empire, Maple City, Cedar. It's a print publication, free, full color, kind of promoting the tourism industry and local characters and the arts and music scenes, and celebrating all of the beauty that is Leelanau County, that is northern Michigan. Funded through advertising. It's very much a labor of love.
You started this when you were 18.
I started this when I was 18. I was lucky in 1996, after I graduated high school. I had this crazy idea of starting a small-town newspaper and asking local businesses to support it with advertising. At that time, Glen Arbor was taking off, and it's been wildly successful as a kind of an economic tourism hub since then.
So you have a website for that?
Yeah, glenarborsun.com.
And you have a personal website?
Mm-hmm. The blog at which one can learn about Between Light and Shadow, my book, is betweenlightandshadow.com, where I list upcoming readings and links to radio and TV shows where I appear, such as this one, betweenlightandshadow.com.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure having you here. Jakob Wheeler, the book, Between Light and Shadow. Fleta Brown is here, and we're going to talk about Edna St. Vincent Millay, which is fun to say.
It is fun to say. I love to say Edna St. Vincent Millay. She was born in 1893 and died in 1950. I love to sometimes bring us older poets to look at and think about again, because their work is just as interesting now as it was then. My guess is many of us know one poem of hers, and maybe by heart. And the one I'm thinking of is called First Fig. You probably don't recognize the title, but the little poem goes like this. My candle burns at both ends. It will not last the night. But ah, my foes, and oh, my friends, it gives a lovely light. Don't you remember that one?
Yes.
She has another tiny poem called Second Fig, and it's only two lines, and it goes like this. Safe upon the solid rock the ugly houses stand. Come and see my shining palace built upon the sand.
Mm.
That's it. Both of these poems celebrate a life lived on the edge, which I have to say perfectly characterizes Millay's own life. She was born in Maine. When she was 7, her mother sent her father away, and she and her 2 sisters were raised to be strong and independent, to love music and literature. When Edna was 20, her mother talked her into entering her poem, Renaissance, in a contest. She won 4th place, and her poem was published, all of which eventually led her to a scholarship to Vassar. She published her first book the year she graduated, That We Should All Be So Lucky. Here's a poem from that book. You hear a lot of passion, a fine control of the line, and her trademark angst. Now remember, this is a very early poem of hers. It's called God's World. O world, I cannot hold thee close enough. Thy winds, thy wide gray skies, thy mists that roll and rise, thy woods this autumn day that ache and sag and all but cry with color, that gaunt crag to crush, to lift the lean of that black bluff, world, world, I cannot get thee close enough. Long have I known a glory in it all, but never knew I this. Here such a passion is as stretcheth me apart. Lord, I do fear thou'st made the world too beautiful this year. My soul is all but out of me. Let fall no burning leaf. Prithee, let no bird call. All that old-fashioned language. She was writing in the fashion of her day. She also wrote her first verse play that year. It was called The Lamp and the Bell and was about love between women. She was openly bisexual. Her friends all called her Vincent. She moved to Greenwich Village and lived what has been called a notoriously bohemian life. She was poor as a church mouse and wrote like crazy. She joined the Provincetown Players and hung around with some of the avant-garde writers of her time. One of them was Floyd Dell, a magazine editor and leader of the Chicago Renaissance and promoter of writers like Theodore Dreiser and Sherwood Anderson and Carl Sandburg. Dell tried hard to get her to marry him, but she said no over and over. She was constantly in love with someone new. You might remember Warren Beatty's film Reds about her love for Dell as well as for the radical writer John Reed. She published A Few Figs from Thistles in 1920. It got a lot of attention for its descriptions of female sexuality. And then her 4th volume, The Harp Weaver, won the Pulitzer Prize in 1923. That year she did get married to Eugen Boissevain, a widower and feminist himself. Boissevain gave up his work to manage Millay's literary career. He spent his time setting up the readings and speaking engagements that made her so well known. Millay said the two of them lived like two bachelors, having an open marriage for all of their 26 years. Boissevain died in 1949 and Millay died in 1950. We may think of Millay's work as old-fashioned since it keeps to a very regular meter and rhyme, and the occasional artificial inversion of words or the occasional prithee or stretcheth. Even for its time, consider that the poet E.E. Cummings was writing, and Dylan Thomas and Ezra Pound. So it's all the more surprising coming from this radical young woman. The words, the passion, feel barely compressed inside the forms, which make the poems feel even more intense. I talked about Gerard Manley Hopkins on another show, and I find some of the same stress and tension in Millay's poems. Both Hopkins and Millay strain after a love that's never quite satisfied. Hopkins after God and Millay after, well, various lovers. I've read those 2 short poems. Here's a sonnet, a rather dim view of love. It's called What Lips My Lips Have Kissed and Where and Why. What lips my lips have kissed and where and why I have forgotten, and what arms have lain under my head till morning. But the rain is full of ghosts tonight that tap and sigh upon the glass and listen for reply. And in my heart there stirs a quiet pain for unremembered lads that not again will turn to me at midnight with a cry. Thus in winter stands the lonely tree, nor knows what birds have vanished one by one, yet knows its boughs more silent than before. I cannot say what loves have come and gone. I only know that summer sang in me a little while that in me sings no more. Okay, here's one last sad look at love. This one is called Witch Wife, and the love is the love of a woman. She is neither pink nor pale, and she never will be all mine. She learned her hands in a fairy tale and her mouth on a valentine. She has more hair than she needs. In the sun, 'tis a woe to me. And her voice is a string of colored beads or steps leading into the sea. She loves me all that she can, and her ways to my ways resign. But she was not made for any man, and she never will be all mine. But we love that kind of sadness, don't we? It's why we love the blues. We love to feel life being lived at its most intense. We love to be there in the poem because it echoes what we've felt at our most intense, which is when we've been most alive. That's Edna St. Vincent Millay.
Edna St. Vincent Millay.
We really love saying that, don't we?
We certainly do. Thank you, Fleeta. Thank you for listening to Michigan Writers on the Air. I'm grateful to Elizabeth Bozzelli, Jakob Wheeler, and Fleeta Brown. Also my thanks to Brock Moorman, Brad Aspie, and Peter Piat. This program is a production of Interlochen Public Radio. Be sure to be listening next month to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. Until then, I wish you great writing, great reading, and the best of all words.